matter searches. So direct action dark matter searches. So where was I? Okay, so I was here. The matrix element for indirect detection scattering. Five. Okay, so this piece you know how to handle in just the usual particle physics ways. This piece is a little bit different. In the next homework, which I'll post to my webpage, and I guess the two people will post it to the wiki later today. It'll be due on the 20th, so Friday of next week. You'll go over a little bit about actually computing this. But I just wanted to mention that this piece is in the limit of q squared goes to zero. So in the extreme non-relativistic limit, S mu is basically zero and the total spin operator of the nucleus. So it's the usual total spin operator you're familiar with from quantum mechanics. And in the case of the nuclear states, the nucleus has some defined overall J and then some magnetic states, MJ. It just in the usual way that you see in quantum mechanics. So when you go and you compute the summed and squared matrix element, what you find at the end of the day, so my summed and squared matrix element and my summed and squared, and that's what these little apostrophes mean, that I square the matrix element and I sum over all initial states, sorry, I average over all initial states, I sum over all final states, and that's what I mean by these little dashes. This, at the end of the day, you find is equal to 8 GF squared gamma M squared J plus 1, where J is the total spin of the nucleus. So this is the bit I'll have you work out in the homework, starting from here. And once you have this, it's straightforward to write down the total cross section. So first of all, let me say that this form corresponds to having this form for the spin operator. So this form technically only applies for q squared goes to zero. And recall that q squared is 2mn times the recoil energy. So what I'm going to do is, for the total cross-section, I'll write the total cross-section as a cross-section at zero recoil energy, and then I'll multiply by a form factor in the same way that I did for the spin-independent case. So the answer is 4 over pi mn gf squared over v squared lambda n squared j plus 1. And I'm going to write the form factor in this way. And this form factor is a little bit more complicated. Actually, get squared. This form factor is a little bit more complicated than the spin independent case. So I'm not going to bother writing it out explicitly, but when I'm at my notes, I'll give you some links to places where you can look up the actual value if you feel like calculating this for a specific theory. Okay, so we have this, and in the same way that we did for the spin-independent case, we can define a so-called reduced cross-section. And this reduced cross-section is just 2 mu n squared v squared over mn d sigma n der at er goes to zero. And this prefactor comes from essentially the factor you would get from integrating over all ders. And having done that, what we get, having done that, well, in this case, I can just write it out explicitly. It's 8 over pi gf squared mu n squared lambda n squared j plus 1. So what I do effectively is I find a limit on the total cross section on the total rate for my experiment, and I translate this limit on the rate, taking into account form factors, into a limit on this. And at this point, I want to compare the results from various different experiments to each other. And these different experiments typically have different targets. So I define effective spin-dependent scattering cross sections of single nucleons. And in this case, very often you can have very different cross sections to scatter off protons and neutrons. So the proton and neutron cases are split up. So the spin-dependent proton scattering cross-section is defined to be, it's not quite exactly the cross-section, but it's mu p over mu n squared sigma tilde n times so this kind of cross-section is appropriate if you expect that your nuclear spin is coming from a proton. So if you look at the structure of nuclei, in a lot of cases, you can treat the structure of nuclei as corresponding to shells of nucleons that are filled up much the same way that you fill up the orbitals of an atom. And typically, a net spin in a nucleus comes from unpaired nucleons within these shells. So if a shell is closed, the nucleons tend to pair up into zero spin combinations. And when you have unpaired nucleons, you get a net nuclear spin. And depending on the structure of nucleus, you very often have only unpaired protons or only unpaired neutrons. So in the case where your target has unpaired protons, you would look at this quantity, where this is the effective coupling for the whole nucleus. This is the JJ plus 1 for the whole nucleus. And this piece is the effective coupling you would get if you looked specifically at the scattering off a proton, and this is the spin of the proton, so this piece just gives you a 3/4, a 1/2 times 3/2, and I can do exactly the same thing for a neutron spin dependent, and I define this as mu n, and this is appropriate for nuclei that have unpaired neutrons. Okay, so this completes the story for spin-dependent dark matter scattering. So I start with my theory in terms of elementary fields, and then I go from these elementary fields to nucleons, and then nucleons to nuclei, and I get some cross-section. And given my cross-section, I plug it into my formula for the total rate. And from the formula for the total rate, I come out with some prediction for a specific experiment. So just the next thing I want to cover is how you actually, or is the current status of experimental searches for dark matter from direct detection. So for this, let me just go back and rewrite the relevant formula
let me just find it here, but let me rewrite the relevant formula for the total rate per unit energy. So I have a number density of targets, so my number of targets per unit mass in the sample. And then I just take the cross-section and I convolve it with the dark matter flux. So just to be clear, this V is the dark matter velocity in the lab frame. And the distribution of dark matter velocities in the lab frame is a little bit different from the distribution of dark matter velocities in the halo frame. So if you recall, in the halo frame, the dark matter distribution, we expect it to be more or less Gaussian, more or less a Maxwellian velocity distribution. On the other hand, we're moving with respect to the dark matter halo. So we see a net dark matter wind on top of the random motion, and then we see an additional net motion from our rotation about the sun. So both of these things turn out to be important, and they play a role in dark matter detection searches. And actually, just for completeness, let me also mention that, this is for spin dependent, and just to collect it, down here, let me write out the so-called the effective spin independent scattering cross section. For this, I compute the corresponding sigma tilde n in the spin dependent case. I multiply it by mu p over mu n squared, and then I divide it by 1 over a squared, where A is the number of nucleons in my target material. So depending on what target I choose for my experiment, I can look for spin-independent scattering, or I can look for spin-dependent scattering of specifically protons or neutrons. And generally, the targets contain more than one material. So even if I have a single material like xenon, there will be different isotopes within that sample, or sometimes I'll use materials made of multiple different kinds of elements. Like one example, sodium iodide. Another is there's some detectors that use silicon and germanium. So in that case, here I effectively assume that I only had one target material, but if I have multiple kinds of target materials, I just get a contribution to the total rate from each of the materials. So I just sum up all the individual contributions. So that's straightforward. Okay, so the upshot of all this is that if I look at this quantity gets a big enhancement for large atomic weight. So I get an a squared enhancement plus a mass enhancement. This quantity, if I go back here, can get an enhancement by the mass for a very heavy mass. And I also get an enhancement by spin if I have a large spin nucleus. So if I was going to design a dark matter search experiment from direct detection, I should take this into account and try to choose materials that are both easy to work with experimentally, but that will also enhance the signals. One other thing is that we're all a bunch of theorists, but to compare with experiment, in this case, especially if you have a slightly unusual dark matter model, you also have to worry. Oh, sorry.
So you said that this gets an enhancement from large atomic weight numbers, or?
So the spin independent case gets a large enhancement from large atomic weights. So I guess I erased here, but remember that. In terms of this, for example, for the scalar-scalar interaction, I had that this was equal to I'm going to mess up some factors, but some stuff times the dark matter nucleus reduced mass, I guess divided by 1 over mn times Anyway, but I also had this this FP Z plus A minus Z. So I get enhancements from that. Okay, but in any case, this is my differential rate. This is my differential rate, and this means that if I measure scattering events, I can put them in bins of different energies and compare the spectrum. But at this point, for the most part, we're just trying to find dark matter. We don't have the luxury of actually having a dark matter scattering spectrum. So most of the time, what you just look at is the total rate. And if I look at the rate in the experiment, the rate in the experiment is not quite just the integral of this rate. So this is the rate at which actual scattering happens. But the rate that you actually see in your experiment, which I'm going to define this way, is not entirely the same as the rate at which the scattering actually happens, because you don't necessarily see all the scattering that happens. So your detector isn't 100% efficient. So your total rate is going to be some efficiency factor if I wanted to get even more fancier, I could also account for the fact that my detector has a finite energy resolution. But for now, I'm going to ignore that. So the point is that I have some finite detection efficiency factor. And typically, this detection efficiency is pretty good for larger recoil energies. But it typically has a small cutoff. So in a lot of cases, you can model it fairly well by some constant, I'll call it epsilon naught, that is slightly less than 1, but kind of on the order of 1, times a theta function . So for the detection efficiency, for your detection efficiency, typically you're only sensitive to energies above a certain value. For higher energies, you're very good, but you're for one reason or another, either because of backgrounds or just because you don't have sensitivity, your detector detector just doesn't detect stuff below some threshold. So in practice, it's not this rigid; it's just kind of more of a smooth fall off. But in a lot of cases, you can model it fairly well this way. So the upshot of all this is that I can draw my expectation for the sensitivity of a dark matter experiment as a function of the dark matter mass. So this applies for spin independent or spin dependent. And if I think about dark matter masses, and I think about the recoil energies I predict, remember that recoil energy is Q squared over 2mn, and Q is, if I get this right, 2 mu n v cos theta. I think I have the factors here right, but you go back in your notes and double check it. But I know that at least this proportionality is fine. And the point is that this mu n is the nucleus mass plus, it's the dark matter nucleus reduced mass. So it's a product of the nucleus mass times the dark matter mass divided by their sum. And this thing goes roughly like the smaller of the dark matter mass or the nuclear mass, at least in the limit where one's much bigger than the other. So for example, if my dark matter is really heavy, the dark matter mass would dominate the denominator, in which case it would cancel off this, and this would be roughly equal to the nuclear mass, and vice versa. So, and then when the masses are kind of equal, I get factors of 1 or 2, and so on. but it's still of this order. But the upshot of this is that you can see that the smaller my dark matter mass, at least relative to my target, the smaller my recoil energy. And at some point, the recoil energy is going to fall below the threshold. Now, it doesn't just fall off below the threshold all of a sudden, because remember, I'm convolving with a velocity distribution. But the velocity distribution also falls off. My velocity distribution also falls off exponentially for large velocities. So the point is that if to get over threshold, given a small dark matter mass, I need a very large velocity, I'm going to have to pay a price for it from the distribution. So the upshot of that is that I'm going to lose sensitivity to dark matter masses at low, I'm going to lose sensitivity to dark matter scattering at low dark matter masses. So for low masses, I'm going to have some fall off. As the dark matter mass approaches the mass of the nucleus, I'm going to get, in a sense, a maximum value, assuming I have reasonable thresholds. And then for very heavy dark matter masses, where I don't have any trouble getting over the threshold energy, at this point, I'm going to pay a price from the fact that the thing that we know is the local dark matter energy density. So the local dark matter energy density is about 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter. So this is fixed from observation from observations of our galaxy. And that means that for very heavy dark matter masses, I'm going to lose sensitivity because my number density goes down. Just in the fact that the heavier my dark matter mass, the fewer dark matter particles I need to make up that energy density. So that means that at large dark matter masses, I also lose sensitivity. So in this region, it goes like 1 over m chi from this rho chi, over at m chi factor. And then in this region, the problem is that my E is falling below the threshold energy except for some very, very unusual velocities. And then I expect to get the most sensitivity down here where my dark matter mass is close to my nuclear mass.
So what's the relationship between the sensitivity and the cross section?
The
y-axis is sigma si.
Sorry. I guess I wasn't clear from this. So the point is that. Most current experiments have looked for dark matter in this way, and they haven't found anything. And because they haven't found anything, this region above the line is ruled out. I didn't explain that. Just because I'm so used to looking at these curves, I didn't think of that. Okay. So the point is that if I observe fewer than some number of events, I put some limit on the rate, and that limit on the rate translates into a limit in this plane. So I rule out everything. Over here. Yeah, sorry about that. Okay, so the current state, and I'll start with the spin independent case. The strongest limits we have come from an experiment called Xenon 100. And this is roughly 50 kilograms of xenon. And xenon
the stable isotopes are roughly 126 to 132 in A, and the atomic number is 54.
So it's quite a heavy element. It's a noble gas, but it's quite a heavy element. And because of that, you get a big A squared enhancement in the rate. The 100 corresponds to 100 kilograms. The 50 kilograms here is the actual so-called fiducial volume, in the sense that the xenon 100 detector is basically a big cylinder of xenon. And the total amount of xenon is on the order of 100 kilograms. But they want to reduce backgrounds. And the backgrounds come from things like radioactivity in the rocks around the detector, or possibly junk from cosmic rays. So to shield from cosmic rays, the xenon 100 detector is deep underground. It's in a lab essentially underneath a mountain in Italy. But the other thing is, to get rid of stuff from radioactive decays in the surrounding rocks, even though they have this volume of xenon, they only take events that happen within an inner so-called fiducial region. And the reason for doing that is that if I have a dark matter particle coming in, the dark matter cross section is really tiny, so my dark matter events in the detector are going to be distributed uniformly around the volume. So I'll get just as many here as out here. But stuff from radioactive decays is coming from the surrounding region here and scatters much more strongly. So the idea is the surrounding radioactivity is going to be confined mostly towards the outer region, whereas the dark matter signal will be everywhere. And by focusing on this inner so-called fiducial region, you get very good background rejection. And in terms of how much data they have, the usual way to quote data is in terms of something called kilogram days. So you multiply the mass of target you have times the number of observation days, and this is effectively the total number of events. This is proportional to the total number of events you expect to be able to see. So xenon 100 has this huge amount of data. Besides xenon 100, there was a smaller xenon 10 earlier. There's also an experiment called CDMS. And this is roughly 5 kilos of germanium. And then they also have some silicon. And the germanium is a fair bit lighter. The germanium isotopes are 70 to 74 with atomic number 32. And they have roughly 500 kilogram days of data. So these experiments have not seen any significant excesses. So taking the results and putting everything together as a function of the dark matter mass and GeV, they put limits on sigma Si, and these are usually quoted in units of centimeter squared. And the limit from xenon 100 looks something like this, with a minimum around 100 GeV. And it starts to fall off a whole lot down near 10 GeV. And I guess this is a log scale. And this lower limit comes in to be like 10 to the minus 44 centimeter squared. So everything up here is ruled out. And then CDMS, which is a slightly smaller, it might do a little bit better at lower masses. So this is a limit from xenon 100, and this is CDMS. And there are lots of other experiments too. So these experiments don't see any net signal. But one thing that's going on in the field that we don't really understand what's going on or how it's working is that there are some other experiments that do seem to have a net signal, at least more scattering signal than they expect from backgrounds. And there are three of them. So the first, and the one that's been around longest, is called a Dhamma. And Dhamma is roughly 250 kilograms of sodium iodide. So the sodium iodide, the heavy scatterer here, so the sodium is 23, and I think it's 12, no, sorry, I think it might be, I forgot the atomic number for sodium. But for iodine, you have 127.83. Is that right? Okay. Again, don't quote me on the 83, but the atomic number is 127. And they have roughly 300,000 kilogram days. So this experiment has been running for, I think, 12 years. And I'll tell you a bit more about it in a second. There's another experiment called Cogent. And this is roughly a half kilogram of germanium. And there's an experiment called CREST of two S's. And this is a combination of calcium, tungsten, and oxygen. And tungsten is a really heavy element. And it's 182 to 186 and 74. OK, so between these three experiments, these three experiments have more scattering events than what they expect from their backgrounds. So it could be that they're underestimating their backgrounds. They don't fully understand that. But it could also be a dark matter signal. The only problem is that if I try to interpret these signals in terms of dark matter scattering, the allowed regions look something like this. So this is Dhamma. This is CREST. And this is Cogent. So the region that seems to fit these results comes about for very light dark matter masses. And these are light dark matter masses that are towards the lower end of the sensitivity of things like xenon 100 CDMS. So it's not quite clear what's going on. It looks like if you do a straightforward interpretation, these results are ruled out by the xenon 100 results. On the other hand, you might worry a little bit about the actual sensitivity in this low mass region. Because this is exactly where the detector is not working so well. The detector is having a hard time seeing the signal. So there's a bit of a controversy in the literature between people on these experiments versus these experiments about what's going on. At this point, it really looks, though, like just a straightforward elastic scattering interpretation of this data in terms of regular spin-independent scattering doesn't quite work. But one interesting possibility, one thing that a lot of people have been working on, is looking at slightly unusual dark matter scattering. So one example is you can have inelastic scattering, where you have two dark matter states, where in the scattering event, your light state scatters into a slightly heavier state. And that changes the kinematics, and that can move things around. Another thing you can do, and this feels a little bit like cheating, is remember that for the spin-independent case, for the spin-independent scattering, people often assume that the relative couplings to protons and neutrons are the same. It turns out that, however, that if you relax this and you allow different FNs and FPs, remember the dependence is FN A minus Z plus FP Z. What some people have suggested is I could have FPs and FNs such that this quantity basically cancels out almost exactly for xenon, which would get rid of the xenon 100 limit. And in that case, the signal regions can still be allowed. So sometimes this is called isospin violating dark matter, but it is a bit of a fine tuning in that if you try to cancel this off to be zero for xenon, you're saying that nature is sort of conspiring against you to make the dark matter scattering on xenon especially small for no good reason. So I mean, nature could work like that, but it just doesn't. It doesn't seem to be an obvious reason for it. And one last comment is that these different regions don't seem to be consistent with each other either, which is another worrisome aspect. On the other hand, it could be that dark matter just has some slightly weird properties in how it scatters. It scatters through a funny momentum, vice has been violating who knows what interaction, and maybe everything can, all those regions for that unusual dark matter would come together and move out and not be ruled out by the other experiments. Yeah.
So I checked the flat on the factory. The flat number of sodium is 11.
Ah. Thanks. 11. Oh, sorry. Yeah. It's not going to be 53.
Yeah.
Thanks. Okay. I wrote down 83, but that's obviously too big. Okay. So actually, but before I go on, though, let me just say a few more things about Dhamma. So this Dhamma signal has been around for a long, long time. And this Dhamma signal has been around for a long, long time. And it seems like it's ruled out by these other experiments. I should also mention that there are actually two Dhamma regions. There's one Dhamma region here at low mass. There's also another Dhamma region here at high mass. And the reason why you get two different regions for Dhamma is that they see a net signal. And this region corresponds to scattering off iodine. And this region corresponds largely to scattering off sodium. OK. So but just one quick comment about xenon. And that is that, Dhamma. The Dhamma signal the Dhamma experiment is very different from these other experiments, because these other experiments are typically designed to be essentially no background. So the idea is that if you see anything, it should be dark matter scattering. Dhamma works in a much, much different way. Dhamma has much, much less background rejection. But what it looks for is something called an annual modulation. So the annual modulation comes from the fact that, here's our galactic disk. Here's the center of the galaxy. And we're out here, so we're roughly 9 kiloparsecs from the center of the galaxy, and we're rotating around the center of the galaxy along with all the other stars. So that's no problem. But on top of that, the thing that's rotating really here is the sun, and of course we know that we're rotating relative to the sun. We're orbiting around the sun. So if you go back, remember that I wrote that our relative velocity is the velocity of the sun plus plus a rotational velocity of the Earth times a cosine omega t minus t naught. So our velocity relative to the halo has this form, where this V sun is roughly 220 kilometers per second, and this delta V Earth is roughly 15 kilometers per second. It's actually 30 kilometers per second, but we're rotating at an angle to the galactic plane, and the angle gives you a factor of 1/2, so that makes a 30 into a 15. But the result of this is that the net dark matter wind, the net dark matter flux we see, is going to depend on the time of year. So if we're sitting here, then and we're rotating around this way, then we're going to see a larger net velocity relative to the halo than if we're here moving in the opposite direction. So that's where this term comes from. And the period, of course, is 1 year. And the phase, it turns out that the maximum happens around June 2nd, and the minimum is around December 2nd. So the upshot of this is that there'll be an annual modulation . So the Delma experiment, even though its background rejection is much weaker than the other experiments, what the Delma experiment did is, or the reasoning is that, okay, who cares about background rejection? I know that dark matter has this annual modulation property. Let's look for this specifically. So what the Delma experiment did is they take all their scattering data, and they focus specifically on scattering events where you only see a single hit in the detector, in the sense that it's a scattering where you see one recoil but not other recoils. And the reason for that is things like background from surrounding radioactivity or cosmic ray muons would typically give you multiple scatterings for a single decay or single cosmic ray. So you focus on the so-called single hit data. And for the single hit data, you look at the time variation of the event rate. So as a function of time, you can plot the modulation in the rate. And the modulation in the rate turns out to be fit very well by a sinusoidal factor with the same period and phase of what you would expect for dark matter. So the period is 1 year, and the maximum is June 2nd, plus or minus a week, and the minimum is December 2nd, plus or minus a week. So the upshot of this is that Delma definitely does see a signal, and they're unambiguously seeing a signal that's modulating in time. And this modulated signal has the same properties as what you would expect from dark matter. So the problem that comes up, though, is that if you interpret the signal in terms of dark matter, the regions that seem to fit also seem to be ruled out by these other experiments. But I wanted to mention the Delma experiment specifically, because the Delma experiment is really set up to look for annual modulation. One other comment is that Cogent also sees an annual modulation that seems to be roughly consistent with Delma, although the phase is a little bit off. Yes. Oh, well, the reason there are two reasons is that, well, Delma has sodium iodide, so there are two elements. And Delma sees some event rate. So the event rate plus using the information about the spectrum is going to give you, the event rate plus information about the spectrum is going to give you some range of dark matter masses and some range of cross sections. And the point is for iodine to get something visible, I need a heavier dark matter mass because iodine is very heavy. And otherwise, if my dark matter is not heavy enough, I'm below threshold. Whereas for sodium, the sodium is much lighter. So I have sensitivity to lighter masses. And that's why I end up in that region.
Data we get about the dark matter masses from Delma is not something that we are going to take seriously, or?
Well, it's just not obvious what the, well, so at this point it really comes down to, there's a theory question and there's an experimental question. The experimental question is, do we really trust these exclusion contours? And there's been some controversy over that, but it looks like Zeno 100 has addressed a lot of that controversy and seems to be fairly stable. So from that point of view, it looks like Zeno 100 is really ruling out these other experiments. On the other hand, though, and this is maybe the more interesting possibility, is that these exclusion regions make certain assumptions. So they make assumptions about how the scattering works. So these curves are based on assuming that Fn is equal to Fp. If I relax that, I can move the stuff around a little bit. I can also move these regions around a little bit if I start changing my dark matter velocity distribution. And that's something we still don't really know unambiguously. And it turns out, and people looked at that on the theory side, and it turns out that can help things a little bit, but it doesn't seem to help things enough. So it's still very much up in the air. But one interesting possibility is that maybe dark matter is scattering, but not in just the simple, elastic way. Maybe the dark matter scattering is inelastic, or maybe there's a more complicated momentum dependence. Who knows what? Yes. Okay. Well, this has come up. So people have said, oh, okay, I can think of lots of things that vary on an annual basis, like, I don't know, the snowpack on the mountain above, or the thickness of the atmosphere. So one thing that some people have considered fairly recently. So Dhamma originally addressed this, but people have come back to it, is that if you look at cosmic ray muons. So we have lots of cosmic ray muons hitting us from outer space, and some small fraction of the cosmic ray muons get through the atmosphere. Most of the muons are stopped in the atmosphere, but some of them actually get through to us. And on an annual basis, the thickness of the atmosphere varies. And depending on how thick or thin the atmosphere is, you'll stop more or less muons. So there's also an annual modulation in the muon flux. And Dhamma addressed this. But these more recent papers, which were based on having better muon flux data and seeing the annual modulation there, said that, OK, let us suppose that Dhamma doesn't reject these muons as well as we think they do. Suppose these muons give you a bigger signal than what Dhamma suggests they do. Could you explain that with that? It turns out that doesn't seem to work. And that doesn't seem to work because the phase is off. So the cosmic ray muons would give you something that is off in the phase. So for example, if I think about temperatures, the peak in the temperature in the summer happens much after June, much later than June 2nd. So a lot of things like this can be ruled out because the phase they predict, the phase they predict doesn't match what Dhamma sees. But at the same time, this Dhamma signal is very intriguing, and something is happening. Like they're seeing something genuinely there, but it's a different question whether that's dark matter or not. And lots of people have come up with ideas for what they could be seeing. It's not dark matter, but none of those suggestions seems to have panned out. So at this point, it's not obvious what's going on with Dhamma, but there's something interesting is happening, and it could be dark matter, but it could be something else. Okay. One last quick thing about Dhamma is that these other experiments, one other thing that I didn't mention in terms of the observed rate or the observed spectrum is that when dark matter hits a nucleus, the nucleus recoils, but you don't necessarily see all the recoil energy in your detector. So the amount of energy you actually observe in your detector is some fraction that's smaller than the actual recoil energy. And this conversion factor is called the quenching factor. So in the case of Dhamma, what Dhamma actually sees is scintillation light. So for a given nuclear recoil energy, they see a certain amount of scintillation light. And So they can use that to normalize, and given the amount of scintillation light, they can go back and say what the nuclear recoil was. And they normalize this amount of scintillation light to the amount of scintillation light you would get from an electron beam going through the detector with the same energy as a nuclear recoil. So this conversion factor goes into the quenching factor. And the problem is, the smaller your quenching factor, the more likely you are to be close to threshold. So one suggestion that came up for Dhamma that to improve the situation is that maybe the quenching factor is much bigger than what you think it is. So the typical quenching factor for iodine is about 0.1. But one suggestion is maybe you have special scatterings where the quenching factor is more like 0.3 for iodine. And when you, if you assume that that's the case, that the quenching factor is not the 0.1 that you usually think it is, this Dhamma region, actually from iodine, shifts over here. So the Dhamma region from iodine, if you have a much bigger Q than what you expect, and a much bigger Q could potentially come about from an effect called channeling, could move the Dhamma region into an area that might be okay. So this was a popular idea for a while, but it doesn't look like quenching actually happens. It doesn't look like this channeling effect happens for iodine in practice. But again, this is just another one of the ideas for what could be going on here. Okay, so one last thing just to wrap up. And that is, I want to mention the spin-dependent searches. So the spin-dependent searches are, well, I don't want to say they're less interesting, but people haven't paid quite as much attention. So I'm running out of time, so I'll just draw the limit plot as a function of the dark matter mass. So for the spin dependent, I'll do the proton spin dependent, and the neutron one is similar. The best experiments at the moment are there's an experiment called Picasso. And the Picasso experiment is actually it's based at Snow Lab, and it's actually a fairly strong Canadian contingent on that. And there's another experiment called Simple. And these best fit values, this is kind of around 10 GeV, and this is around 100 GeV. And the sensitivity of these, in terms of just raw cross sections relative to spin independent, is a bit less, because you don't get this big A squared enhancement. The JJ plus one factors tend to be a bit smaller. So this is more like 10 to the minus 38 centimeters squared, as opposed to the 10 to the minus 44 I had for spin independent. So these spin dependent searches are also interesting. There are certain cases where there are cases where dark matter scatters primarily this way and not that way, particularly if the dark matter is very light. On the other hand, for these spin-dependent searches, there are also various indirect bounds on dark matter scattering strength. So these indirect bounds on dark matter scattering strength tend not to be very important relative to the spin-independent cross-sections, but they tend to be important relative to the spin-dependent cross-sections. So these indirect bounds, you get a bound from colliders, and you also get a bound from solar capture of dark matter. Now, both of these limits are somewhat model dependent, so you have to make certain assumptions about the structure of the dark matter and how the dark matter decays or annihilates. But these indirect bounds, under some fairly mild assumptions, do seem to be stronger than the direct bounds at this point. So one of the things I'm going to get to next week is talking about these other indirect bounds. So I guess I have a couple minutes left. So just very quickly, just to give you a preview of next week, I'm going to talk about so-called indirect detection. And indirect detection means you look for the signals of dark matter in our galaxy, or typically in our galaxy, from dark matter annihilation. So the idea of indirect detection is you have dark matter annihilating somewhere in outer space, and that produces cosmic rays, and you see a cosmic ray signal from dark matter. I'm also going to look at collider searches. And if I have time, I'm also going to talk about axions as dark matter. So axions are these very, very light particles that behave much, much differently from WIMPs. They also count as non-thermal dark matter. But they address a long-standing problem in QCD, the so-called strong CP problem. And they're an interesting alternative to WIMP dark matter. And the searches for them are completely different. So I'll also cover that. Oh, sorry, next. Okay, so I'll wrap it up there. Have a good weekend. I'll post the new homework later today on my website. And Tibor will follow it up. I guess your homework for this week is due today, which I guess you get it. Oh, great. Okay. But yeah, it'd be better if you get into deeper than me. Okay, yeah. But yeah, and if you have questions about anything, drop them in my office or send me an email or whatever.